Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and I'm glad to have you listening. In the first hour today, here's the question that we're going to try to toss around. How can the public become involved in the planning of public spaces? Our guest for the program this morning is a landscape architect and project manager with some 30 years of experience working in these kinds of projects, big public projects. This is Barbara Faga. She is executive vice president and a principal with EDAW. That's a large international planning and urban design firm. Their headquarters are in San Francisco, although they have offices various other places here in the United States and also internationally. She is in Atlanta. She has a degree in landscape architecture from Michigan State University, where she has received the Distinguished Alumni Award. She also did graduate work at Georgia Tech in city planning. Design Intelligence named her one of the 15 top women who are changing the world of architecture, and she has been involved in projects in a number of cities around the country, in Atlanta, also places like Boston and Philadelphia, and also Barcelona. She is, in addition, the author of a book that sets out a number of case studies, taking a look at projects in various places like Boston and New York and Atlanta and Chicago, and taking a look at just how difficult this kind of negotiation process can be when you get together politics and economics and planning and public opinion and all try to get together and sort out competing interests and come up with a plan that everybody can agree to. This is a book that's titled Designing Public Consensus, and the subtitle is The Civic Theater of Community Participation for Architects, Landscape Architects, Planners, and Urban Designers. And it is a book that's primarily intended for people like that who do that for a living, but it's also interesting if you're interested in architecture, if you're interested in planning, if you have some interest in local politics and citizen activism, well, all of those things really do enter into it. The book is published by John Wiley and Sons, so you might want to take a look at it. This morning, as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. We always like to welcome people into the program. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep our program moving along, get in as many different people as possible. But questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. At any point here, if you have questions, comments, you want to be a part of the conversation, you can do that. Ms. Faga, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, well, we appreciate it. I'm happy to be asked.
Well, I'm just curious about how it is you got into this particular area and landscape architecture and design of these kinds of big public projects. Was that something that you wanted to do from early on in your college education? Did it, at some point, did something grabbed you and you just thought, well, that's really what I would like to do?
I think I just started out as a intern in a landscape architecture firm in Lansing, Michigan. When I was a junior in high school, you're looking for a summer job, and I was the receptionist and the gopher, and was interested always in art and architecture, and then just went on, and it's what I've done all of my life, and I really enjoy it. It's a great profession.
Yeah, and I think that maybe, here on the program, off and on, we've certainly talked about architecture and buildings, and I guess people understand what architects do. That is, they're the people that design buildings. Maybe some people might not be exactly sure what a landscape architect does.
Well, it's in the tradition of Frederick Law Olmsted, and landscape architects do a variety of things. Designing gardens, most people think of landscape designers doing their gardens and their homes, all the way to designing cities and large parks and Central Park. All of these great outdoor spaces were all designed by landscape architects, and I think it's something that people walk through and they don't understand that people took a long time designing it, all the Disney parks. Everything that's outside is what we say that we do.
Mm-hmm. You just this may be sort of a small point, but in the introduction to the book, you refer to yourself both as city planner and urban designer. Are those two things significantly different?
Not really. They're similar. I think there's city planners who are involved in strategy and organizing cities, and urban designers look a little more at design. So you can, there's so many aspects to this, and I'm noticing as I speak in universities around the country that a lot of people in colleges are interested now in urban planning, urban design. Mm-hmm. They want to change the environment that we live in, and you know, people are opposed to sprawl and want to bring things more into cities, and as this is the century of the urbanization in cities, people are more interested.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine that someone might rather refer to themselves as an urban designer rather than a city planner, just because somehow urban design sounds more artistic and city planning sounds more sounds like it has much more to do with numbers and figures and, you know, drawing straight lines and setting up grids, and that somehow the art part that doesn't quite come through. And I'm sure that that's doing an injustice to city planners.
Well, city planners play a really important role. They're talking about what land uses go together and what population projections do to cities, and looking at the census all of the time. So there's so much of this planning, you know, where rapid transit would go. I just came from a workshop in Orlando, Florida, with the University of Pennsylvania and University of Miami, and they had probably a total of 30 students and several professionals. It was a week-long workshop, and it was to discuss what Florida would be like in 2020, 2040, 2060. You know, when you're looking at the future, and everybody has now, you know, of a number of generations has played SimCity, and they see what you can do with cities now and with redevelopment. So what we did for a week was put rapid transit throughout the state of Florida, look at storm surge and hurricane patterns and where development would go and where new cities might be located. It's a very interesting profession where you get to look at the future.
Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe we can now start to draw some connections between that activity and public opinion. I think probably most people, what they like to do as far as planning is concerned, is complain mm-hmm. about things that they don't like, not so much. And I suppose maybe that's the nature of people. It's more likely they're going to complain about things they don't like rather than talk about things they do. But I'm sure that now, and if you ask people to talk about the cities and the towns where they live, one of their complaints might be that it seems that, in fact, that there isn't much planning going on, that things just happen, and that they don't always happen for the best.
Well, a lot of things are going on, and I think when I first approached looking at this book, I was thinking that sometimes when you involve the public, it will homogenize the plan, mm-hmm. sort of bring it down to its base elements. But as I researched this over the past couple of years and looked at my experiences and many other people's experiences, because what I was trying to do was have a conversation in the book among designers and the public, what I found and what others found is that really when you have an educated public, it really makes the entire design better, makes the plan better, because people understand it and they can carry it forward, and then they're knowledgeable on what they're discussing. And what we're finding is people go to public meetings, they enjoy public meetings, and there's some people who live for public meetings. And when they come and they become more and more educated, it's actually a pleasure to work with the public, and people turn less toward complaining, more toward what the future will look like, and actually have a say in what the future will look like.
Mm-hmm. You touch on something that I'm sure that may be a sore spot for some architects and some designers, and that is they and their colleagues work together to produce some kind of unique vision. And I know that architects like to particularly stress the art part of what they're doing. That is, they're not just like high-level building contractors. That what they're doing is that they're designing something that is very distinct and is something of a personal statement. And I'm sure that people complain that the designers complain that what happens when you start to involve the public and you get more people involved, you get more opinions, you have more people saying, I want this, and somebody else says, I want this, that you're, if indeed at the beginning you had some kind of design in mind, something that you thought both functioned well in a mechanical sense and was also beautiful, that once you get all these other people and their ideas into the project, that your original vision gets diluted to the point where there's nothing original or special about it anymore.
Yeah, we sort of refer to that as homogenizing the design. I think that can happen. If you're experienced in public process and you understand how to bring the public along, it doesn't happen. Because what you find is people will come in and they see, we'll take a park for instance, they understand that we're designing a park and it has some buildings in it. And you start giving people choices and they see different alternatives that they might select. And what I notice is people will usually go to the best alternative. It's really an amazing discussion. And if they don't start out doing that, you just have to continue to educate. And everybody goes home and they look at the web and they look at information that they have. And I think the public is has a lot of knowledge as to what is going on. You know, people are more traveled. They understand what Central Park looks like, what the mall in Washington, D.C. looks like, what Disney World looks like, and bring those experiences.
Here, I think that it's an opportunity to make a point, and certainly it's made in the book, that there, if you look at the period, say, you know, before 1960, maybe certainly before 1950, mm-hmm. big urban development projects essentially were carried out, were planned behind closed doors. And you just can't do that anymore, not only because citizen involvement in some cases may be mandated, but even if it wasn't, now people would demand to be involved. So people are involved. Although, again, as the someone here in the book makes the point, I'm not sure if it's you or the person who wrote the preface, that often that involvement starts out by people objecting, starting out by people saying, no, we don't want that. And then the challenge for somebody like you is to actually bring people in the process in a more constructive way. But it seems to me to be pretty significant that we have this major sort of dividing line of time when people weren't consulted. Plans were just made and then they were presented and this was it, to what we have now where people are demanding, they're standing up and demanding to be a part of the process.
Well, it's taken the form of, for example, waterfronts in cities. For many years, the 50s, 60s, a lot of the transportation networks, the roads were built right along the waterfronts. Well, now, suddenly, you know, people have noticed that waterfronts are a very valuable part of their city. So in some cases, those roads are being depressed. They're being channeled or tunneled underground, as with the big dig in Boston. And what you find is you get so much better open space, and you add to the quality of life in these cities that you didn't have before. And all of those road discussions, I'm sure, were made behind closed doors. But that doesn't happen anymore. Roads get stopped now. And that was sort of my introduction to public process, was working on large projects that I saw could be stopped very easily by citizens who had organized against a certain development or a new roadway or a new power plant or a new whatever it is. And in some cases, those were the right decision. Mm-hmm. And well, now it has changed. Now they're being built or being changed according to what the public has in mind.
Yeah, I think that's an important point too, and something that as you point out, that something now that public officials have learned at their peril, that is, if you don't have support, that not only can people, if they're opposed to a project, not only can they simply delay it, they can actually make it not happen. They can stop it completely, and that you've got to mobilize that support, or else it is very likely that your project's not going to happen.
Exactly. And what is interesting to me is when developers or the public sector decide they're going to do a project, that they involve the public as soon as possible. You know, you can't just, nobody likes those kind of surprises where they just spin out a drawing or a diagram and say, this is what we're going to be doing in this area of the city. And especially if it involves people's homes, people's routes to work. You know, we sometimes joke about when you go to a public meeting what people's two questions are, where do I live and where do I park?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they want to know immediately. And if you can solve that and sort of move on to what the bigger issues are. And as these cities need to grow, that we need more density in the cities, we need to get away from the sprawl that we've had for years and plan more like the European cities where we have urban open space or outside open space where it's protected, then we're making better decisions about planning. We just can't go on and on and on redeveloping our open areas, our suburbs into one house per half an acre. It's just not going to work. We see that on our roads all the time now.
Let me introduce again our guest, and we have a caller to bring into the conversation. The guest today, Barbara Faga. She is a landscape architect and project manager. She's executive vice president and principal with EDAW. That's a large international planning and urban design firm headquartered in San Francisco. She works in Atlanta. They have offices also other places in the United States and around the world. And she is the author of the book Designing Public Consensus, which takes a look at how people who work designing public spaces, architects, landscape architects, urban planners and designers, how they can go about bringing the public into the process to get their input and also support. So if that's something that you're interested in, Wiley is the publisher of the book. You could take a look at it. And of course, questions here on the program, as always, are welcome. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. And we have a caller here where we are in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. In listening to public talking about planning, it seems that people often forget that it's sort of a dynamic process of stuff that goes on, including private individuals who come up with their own ideas about what they want to do with land that they want to buy or that they already own. And so there's this kind of interaction that goes on. We've also got somebody who writes in our local paper about, he doesn't much like the city I come from. Although he lives there, he's got a bone of contention with it. It's been going on for, 10 years or more. And his letters act as though a city has complete control over what private individuals and businesses do and whether they fail or thrive or whatever. There is some interaction, but, this is a complex society, and so plans are great and very, very important. But I think people need to remember that there's it's more complex than having a plan. We can't totally. There's some things that government agencies can plan and dictate based on the law, but there's other things they can't control, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, you're exactly right. The city, by law, does control zoning and land use and a lot of other signs and traffic and many other things. So when designers and developers put their plans together, they take into account, or hopefully they take into account, all of those issues, and then that's when they present a plan to the public. So you're right. It is a joint partnership between the person doing the developing, whether it's private or public sector, the city or the governing body, and the public now that make these plans go forward. And that's where the dynamics are in terms of if and when the plan does go forward. How do you get to a decision that the public and the public sector, the elected officials and the neighborhoods and the people in the city support? So it's a very dynamic process, but interesting.
It also seems to me that we, as individuals and families, affect some of the pressures by the kind of transportation we will accept and use and the size of our families and the kind of housing that we'll accept and use. And some of that has to, we may find ourselves needing to change our views. When I mention to people that I'm perturbed when somebody has five kids, they say, nobody's going to tell me how many kids to have. And I think, yeah, but don't complain about urban sprawl if you're creating five more households, you know, in the future. And how many more cars are these folks going to drive, and so forth. So it's we need to be taking some personal responsibility ourselves. I'm kind of rambling here, but those are just some thoughts that occurred to me. Hey, your book sounds very interesting. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if you want to react to that at all.
Well, yes, I agree. I think when I travel, you know, and everybody who travels, and you say where you live, and then people say, oh, they have a lot of traffic there. You know, how long does it take you to get to work? Well, it takes me 4 minutes to get to work because I live close to work. You make your choices on what car you drive, you know, how many children you have, where you live, how long it is to work. And I think when people make their choice to drive 40 minutes to work or an hour and a half to work, that is their choice, and then they live with it. But I am interested when people continually complain about the transportation issues and not having rapid transit, you know, trains and other things in their location. They ought to make that known to their elected officials.
Questions, other questions are welcome. We're getting close to the midpoint here. Again, our guest is Barbara Faga. She's a landscape architect with many years of experience as an architect and also project manager. And as I mentioned, she works for this very large international planning and urban design firm, EDAW. She's executive vice president and principal with EDAW and has been involved in projects in a lot of different places, including, just to name a few, Boston, Philadelphia, Atlanta, and also in Barcelona. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Perhaps this is just because you are a landscape architect, that a number of the cases you present in the book have to do with attempts to develop green space in cities. But I just am interested in perhaps asking the general question whether, in fact, you think that it is the case, has been the case, is the case, that in large cities there is this desire for developing more green space and getting more natural content into the interspersed in with the built environment.
Well, there's always an attempt and a wish, I believe, among elected officials to have more open space, because as we build these cities up and the single-family homes in the downtowns have changed over the years to become retail and then condo buildings, and you sort of see how different cities have progressed over the years. So what you get into when you start looking at that is how do you actually develop that open space? And a lot of times open space, I can use, for example, Centennial Olympic Park in Atlanta, that came about as a desire by the Olympic Organizing Committee in Atlanta to build a large park that would be used for the sponsor venue in downtown Atlanta. And Billy Payne, who was head of the Olympics at the time, looked out over his out of his office, saw a lot of parking lots and old warehouse buildings, and thought this would make a great location. So there was a park design drawn up and that we put together and worked on with a variety of the state of Georgia, the city of Atlanta, many public and private groups here, but a 20-acre park built in downtown Atlanta that held that sponsor village during the Olympics, and then was redone after the Olympics to have a lot of other activities in it. And since then, the parks and open space are big economic development tools, because what has happened is there's been over $2 billion worth of redevelopment around Centennial Olympic Park, including a new aquarium, a new Koch Museum, the new Civil Rights Museum will go there, new office buildings, new hotels, and it was in an area that was it was a pretty depressed part of Atlanta. So when you put open space in, people want to be around the open space. That's how Central Park was developed. That's how many parks were developed. That's how Boston developed their whole Emerald Necklace that now they're adding to with a lot of new public open space over the tunnels and roads for the Big Dig. So open space is always a welcome piece of redevelopment plan. I think many redevelopment plans in downtown cities right now have a large portion of them as open space to add to the quality of life for the people living in the cities.
Do you think that it is particularly in when you're talking about architecture and design, the design of the built environment in big cities, that there is more of an attempt to have an integration of the built environment and the natural environment in a way that sort of makes sense, where the two things complement each other, rather than what it in the past seems to have been the case, where the people who were designing the built environment, it was almost as if they didn't care about the natural environment, that wasn't their business. They were putting a building on top of a piece of land, and that was that.
Well, I guess over history of civilization, that's always been the way development happens. Yeah, there's ways, you know, you can solve anything with money. So engineers can make anything happen, any bridge, any road, any viaduct, any anything. And you're right, that has happened over the years. And it's really taken a very interested public to decide that's not how it's going to happen now. And yes, a private developer can come in and say, this is what I want to build here. And many times they've gone ahead, many times they've been stopped. It's a little more iffy when the public sector decides we're going to build a road here or we're going to build something, you know, wherever. And then you get into that give and take between public process and are we going to build it, and when are we going to build it? And that's the part that I find that is very intriguing, because things don't happen fast. Things happen as a process, and I really am intrigued by the process of when it starts out, you know, when the project is announced, and then people will see the project in the newspapers or wherever, they'll hear about it, or now, you know, so much information and misinformation is spread around on the web that you can find out anything or pretty much make up anything. And what happens then is you can kind of judge by how the project is going forward. Is it going to be an organized, open, transparent public process, or is somebody trying to get things through quickly because of an election coming up or something happening coming up? And you can kind of trace how these projects progress. And you know, we talk about in Boston how we were designing the last open space big park in downtown Boston over in the Wharf District area, which is between the waterfront there and Faneuil Hall, and where the aquarium is located, and in a lovely area of downtown Boston. But people were originally we were told there wasn't a huge constituency and people were not interested in what went on in that area. Well, you know, the first public meeting, 250 people came. So people are very interested in what happens in their area. And the one thing about Boston is, you know, public sport in Boston are baseball, politics, and revenge. So people would show up and just... they were upset that the park had this or the park didn't have this, and wanted to take in every other issue that was going on in the area. So it became a very interesting public, very public, and played out in the newspapers and pretty much all over Boston as to how this park would be designed in the end.
Well, and it's funny because the first chapter in the book is about that experience and about the bruising nature of the process for you all coming from outside of Boston. That was part of the issue. I think perhaps people in Boston said, oh, these people, they don't know Boston, they're not from here. But you started out, you presented a variety of designs, and then almost immediately people started to complain about them and say, oh, they were no good. And the people who wrote about architecture weighed in, and academics weighed in, and it was almost like they just had fun arguing about it. But then at the end of the day, though, actually the final design was very much like one of the initial designs that you presented. So somehow, after all of that wrangling, you managed to get enough consensus and enough people behind a particular design, much like one of your first designs, and it actually went forward. But it sounds like along the way you might have thought, you weren't going to make it through the process.
Well, and we didn't think we were going to make it through the process. But it is, and I think in the end, you know, when you think about you're laying in bed or in a hotel room or in the shower or wherever, and you're thinking about how to make the public engage, and how do they understand, and what, as I went through it and sat through 250, you know, public meetings, there were a lot of public meetings there, and then on other projects that we've worked on where you can get yourself into 100 and some public meetings, and in the end, at the end of the day, you become friends with a lot of the people that you're working with, which is a very nice outcome, and you learn a lot. You learn a lot about what people think in their neighborhoods and how they want to live and what they want to look at. And the thing about Boston that I thought was interesting is there are several high-rise residential towers around the neighborhood, and the people doing the planning before us, you know, there have been many plans before us because the big dig has been going on for 15, 20 years, and their decision was that this would be a paved open space where there would be band concerts and whatever. And what the people who actually lived there wanted was something pretty. That's what they asked for, landscape. We want to look at fountains. We want to look at green. We want to look at flowers. And that changed immediately and was interesting. So, but what you get in these areas, you know, when you're doing these big public projects, you have the business community, you have the churches, you have the public sector, the elected officials, the city planners, the neighborhood groups, the, you know, everybody who's interested from inside and outside the area, and they all come, and what I found is everybody comes with their own vision. They all have their own little vision of what is going to happen here. And then somehow you have to combine that into one vision. And it doesn't take one meeting or two meetings. It takes a lot of meetings. It has to be an open, honest process. It's got to be out there so everybody sees it. The press has to be involved. And people have to understand that they're working on a solution. And that's one of the most important things, is that they all understand that in the end we're going to come to a decision here and participate. That's an important thing, but in the end, we're all going to decide that we're going to build something that most of us will like.
Yeah. Just real quick, and I promise I have callers here, I will get right to them. If you look at this particular case of Boston, and as I mentioned, the final design was close to one of the original five that you presented in that first charrette when you had designs and you had people come in and look at them. Do you think you must have felt pretty good about those first designs? Do you think that the one that you finally came up with was indeed improved because of the public comments that you got?
Definitely. It was definitely improved. Had more landscape in it. The fountain was a better design. Had a building there for the National Park Service that they could use to get their information out and arrange people to go to Spectacle Island, and much better design, yes.
Okay. Oh, we have some callers here. We'll get to them in just a second. I want to introduce again our guest, Barbara Faga. She is Executive Vice President and Principal with EDAW. That's a large international planning and urban design firm. They're headquartered in San Francisco, have offices various places in the United States and also outside. She is in Atlanta. She has a number of years' experience as landscape architect and project manager, has a degree in landscape architecture from Michigan State, did her graduate work at Georgia Tech in city planning, has been named one of the top 15 women changing the world of architecture. She's been involved in projects in a number of cities, including Atlanta, Boston, Philadelphia, Barcelona. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Chicago. Line one. Hello.
I've got some ideas I'll probably get put down, but why don't they take all the trash that's disposed of and make some attractive hills and valleys out of that? We had something here in Chicago called the Brickyard, and they emptied it out. It was used for clay, and then they filled it in with trash, and then they left a pile of trash on top of it. Well, as soon as winter came, the kids all found it, and they were up there with their sleds and everything. They called it Mount Trashmore. Since then, that's been removed. But why can't they take some area here in, out of the city and build some hills and valleys where all the motorcycle guys can go out there and you can picnic out there on a cold, sunny day? There's a hill right over here that the WPA left behind, and I see people out there in shorts on a cold, sunny day using that. Why don't they try to do something like that on an attractive landscape with some hills?
Well, Ms. Figa, can you talk about that in some way?
Well, they do that all over the country. I think what you need to do is call your elected officials and mention that to them. That's a, you know, it's open space. It's a huge opportunity, and they're taking landfills, you know, through New Jersey and redeveloping those into large meadowlands, so large open space redevelopment areas.
Well, as soon as you have some hills, that means you're out of the wind on a sunny day. You can picnic there.
Mm-hmm.
And the motorcycle guys, they head for that with their hill climbs. And the kids, as soon as the snows are out there with their sleds. But in Chicago, it's flat. Nothing for anybody. You have to drive miles to get to that. That's my thought. But all this trash is thrown away or incinerated. That's a nuisance, too. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's go on to another call. Here we have someone in Kankakee. This is line number two. Hello.
Please accept your caller's apologies if a similar question has already been submitted. But your caller would wish to mention the names of certain urbanologists and obtain the comments of the guest on their work. First, Andre Duaney and Elizabeth Plater Zyberk in the New Urbanism. Second, the late Jane Jacobs. And third, William McDonald. Thank you.
Okay, well, you want to talk about some of those folks?
All brilliant designers. All have contributed so much to redevelopment and redesign. In fact, Dean Plater Zyberk was part of the group I was with last week in Orlando with the University of Miami and working on this 2060 plan for Florida. But there are many, many designers out there working right now on many projects. And if you, and it sounds like the caller had seen a lot of these articles, if you pick up Landscape Architecture Magazine or Architecture Magazine or any of the design magazines, have a lot of information about new projects, old projects that are being redone, urbanization, revitalization of cities, all of these very important. All of these movements very important. You know, a new urbanism, old urbanism, sustainability. There's so much right now going on in terms of design and redesign of cities that it's very intriguing. A lot on the web also.
Mm-hmm.
And all of our children are off playing on SimCity, which is exactly what they should be doing.
Well, if I don't know if this is too complicated a question, but if you were to summarize in a couple of key points what the most important ideas are now as people are thinking about redesign of cities, and it's particularly, I think, if you have an existing city, if you're starting from the ground up, that you could do anything that you want. But if you're dealing with an already existing infrastructure, then in some sense you're limited by what's already there. If you talk about what can be done with an existing city, are there a couple of key ideas you think that all of the people who are working in this area are trying to get at?
I think Boston is a great example. There is one of the oldest cities, a city that has, I think, their largest export is diplomas. They have so many students there, and I have a daughter who went to school there. And when you go to Boston, the streets are just teeming with nice, young, smart children carrying shopping bags that we've all been paying for over the years. And the students love it there. They would love to stay there, I'm sure, most of them. But what the city has done is recreate itself by adding density, new residential areas downtown, and you need the residential population to then fuel the the new retail and shopping areas and have the open space that they've created by redoing this big dig project, and look at all the transportation. So the transit's there. You can live there without a car. You can get around everywhere. The open space is there. There's beautiful open space areas. And you can live in pretty much any kind of and price accommodation you want. So there's, you know, lovely homes and townhomes and apartments near the colleges that are somewhat subsidized by the universities. And you can do pretty much anything there. And I think that's you know, if you've read any of Richard Florida's books about where people want to live and what people want to do and what the new mentality is as far as where the IT people are located and where the best cities are. And I'm always interested in those sites on the web of what the best locations are. And the best locations pretty much have to do with density, transit, and open space. And that's what attracts people.
Hmm. I'm interested. You talked about the fact that recently you were taking part in a conference that was in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I'm wondering to what extent now, you know, we talked a little bit earlier, I think I asked this question about whether, you know, how much consideration now was given to, in urban design, was given to a real integration of the built environment and the natural environment, you know, having those two things be in harmony. And certainly there are people that are trying to do that and probably have always tried to do that, just like there are always people who have just not cared. But I'm wondering to, in a different sort of way, and this may particularly be an issue for people who live in coastal areas, but maybe not just in coastal areas, how designers are having to take into account nature more and more, and not just in the sense that you want there to be some harmony between the built environment and the natural environment, but that there you really have to take into consideration the power, perhaps the destructive power of nature in deciding what you're going to build and where you're going to build. And I wonder whether you think as time goes along here that that's something that designers and planners and architects perhaps are going to have to think more about.
Well, I know there's a lot I live in Miami Beach, and there's a lot about hurricanes. And, you know, you're always watching the weather to see where the hurricanes are coming from and what has happened over the Gulf Coast over the last couple of years. We've all seen what can happen in terms of development, redevelopment in those locations. And there's a number of organizations that are looking at how to put together the effects of hurricanes, climate change on development. The Regional Plan Association, RPA, from in New York has a website. I think it's rpa.org. I'm not sure if I have that right or not. But they have a lot of information on their site, or you can Google a lot of information right now about climate change, storm surge, hurricane paths, wind damage, and you know, as we saw in Vice President Gore's film. Also, people are very interested in this right now, and we look at it a lot. We're doing a redevelopment of a waterfront in Tampa, Florida, and to look at all the redevelopment we're doing there, we're looking at storm surge and what would happen and making the pathways and the boardwalks and everything some sort of hurricane-proof development. And that's what people are looking for. You know, they want to understand what climate change will do and how that will affect anything that's built around them or where they live. You know, there's some that are actually are sort of scary-looking graphics that show what storm surge does in some of these locations that pretty much takes away a lot of the a lot of the coastline as we know it. And I don't think we want to dwell on that so much, but we do need to make better decisions in terms of planning and evacuation and all of those items. And people are interested in that. When you go to Sarasota County and you speak to them about their parks and redevelopment, and you always get into these issues in terms of, as I guess you do on the West Coast, in terms of earthquakes and how to plan. But the public knows all this because they're reading the papers and reading the web and understanding what the development pressures are, and you know, sometimes better than the people actually working on the projects.
Hmm. We talked about the fact that you and your firm have been involved in some big projects here in big cities here in the United States. And sort of the central theme of our conversation and also of the book that I've mentioned, Designing Public Consensus, is that when you are doing a big project like that, the public, you've got to have them on board. They must be consulted. They demand to be consulted. And if you don't have public support, not only can things just be knocked off the rail, they can be knocked off the rails maybe temporarily, but they can be knocked off the rails permanently. It can mean the difference between either doing the project or not doing the project. So getting public consensus and having people involved is important, and I know that you would argue that it's good in the long run for the project, that the projects are better for that kind of input. Having said all that, I'm just curious because I know that you and your firm have been involved in some projects outside of the United States. Are things different how this works, and particularly the whole issue of public input, public consensus, is that different in other countries, or is it essentially the same?
Well, I think it depends on the country, but I'm working in Europe right now, and you know, many of the projects there, yes, the public does have, of course, some comment, and we take the projects to the public and in a variety of forums and explain them and talk about them and have open houses where people see models and what this redevelopment will look like and how it will affect them and what types of open space will be involved and how many units of housing and what effect that will have on the schools and all of the other public parts of their city and transportation. And it's very similar. Very similar. And people are interested in the same things. How will this affect me? What will this do for me? What are the gardens going to look like? Is it going to be pretty? That's always a comment. And it seems so simple to ask that comment and to have people talk about it. But it is important to have people feel that what is going to happen is going to improve their quality of life. Mm-hmm. And we're finding that in Barcelona all over.
You know, I think that's interesting that anybody would somehow think that was surprising, that people would be concerned about how things would look. They would be concerned about the aesthetic nature of the environment and whether things are going to be attractive or not. I guess I would think that anybody anywhere, people would that would be important to them. And yet it's make it sound like in some cases it can almost be a surprise.
Well, it is a surprise sometimes because I think people are more interested in the landscape now than they are in the paving and all those other pieces that are going on, or how much water is there, or is it going to be something where they get a nice view and they get to see something. And it's important to be able to portray that to the public, because a lot of times designers will go in, or public officials, with a plan, and people just don't read plans. They don't understand plans. They don't see the spatial aspects of plans. They have to see watercolors or drawings or simulations, or they have to understand what it looks like from their viewpoint. And that's how they understand what the project will be. You know, I don't expect that I can walk in and try a court case, and I don't expect an attorney to come in and immediately understand what I'm showing them either. So it is a process of having the right graphics and the right pieces to display what things look like. But I do notice that the 20-year-olds really understand plans and pieces, I think mostly from playing all these games they've been so in tune with on all the Sim Cities and everything else that they've participated in.
Hmm. And just as a way of finishing up here, do public officials always know? Do they really always know just how important? You'd think that they would, that they would always know how important public support is, and yet sometimes does it surprise you that they don't realize just how much effort they need to put into mustering public support for a project?
Well, I think it is, you know, it comes down to the people who are really good elected officials do understand that. They don't have to be told or encouraged to do that. Their first response is to go to the public and see what they want. You sort of see this throughout the United States with the mayors who are doing very well and elected officials who are doing very well. But, you know, there's always a few who think that by getting public support that will just make things not go as fast, it'll tie things up, and those are the people you kind of want to stay away from because it doesn't help to have that attitude. Transparency is probably the biggest thing with any kind of public process and any new development is you want to get your message out there early and talk about it and show people how it will affect them for the good.
Well, we will have to leave it at that. Our guest this morning, Barbara Faga, is Executive Vice President and Principal with EDAW. That's a large international planning and urban design firm. She has many years' experience as a landscape architect and project manager. She's been involved in projects in a lot of different places, just to name a few, Atlanta, Boston, Philadelphia. And if you're interested in this whole business of getting public participation in design, urban design projects, you might look at her book, Designing Public Consensus. It's published by Wiley. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, David. I enjoyed it.